Welcome to the Sandman Slept Here, part of the Justice Society Presents feed on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your co-hosts, Paul Ken, along with Ryan Daly and Max Romero. Hey guys, how you doing?
Hey Paul, how
are
you?
Well, how are you?
On this show, we review the comic book adventures of the Golden Age hero, Wesley Dodds, the Sandman, and his partner, Diane Belmont, specifically the Vertigo book from the 1990s, Sandman Mystery Theater. This episode is sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. A while back, we realized that we needed some help with expenses, so we launched the Patreon, and you folks just stepped right in to help keep the network going. If you're enjoying the shows on the Justice Society Presents podcast feed, the best way to support the show is by visiting patreon.com/FW podcasts.
And while you're there, please consider supporting the Fire and Water Podcast Network. At certain tiers, you will get mentioned on the show of your choice. Just like our all-star squadron of supporters who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks to
Alex Osias,
Bill Beer,
Bruno Diaz,
Chris Mort,
Craig Fletcher,
DC Dave,
Devin Clancy,
Ducky,
Extremely Uncanny,
Jason Keen,
Jay Campbell,
Keith G. Baker,
Kevin Wetter,
Mark Baker Wright,
Matt Ev,
Michael Bailey,
Michael Crouch,
Mike Zonkowski,
Roger Preeb,
Little Russell Burbage,
Symbol Pending,
Ted Kilvington,
and Tim Price.
Again, please visit our Patreon at www.patreon.com/FWpodcasts.
All right, listeners, if you want to read along and you don't have the original issues, where can you do that? Of course, the digital for every issue is available on DC Universe app, but in order to read Vertigo books, you do need the Ultra subscription. The first half of the series or so is reprinted in several trades, as well as the Compendium Volume 1, which is what I'm reading from. I should also note that Volume 2 just came out, and I received my copies since the last episode came out. So that's the only place most of the second half of the series has been reprinted at all. We're not there yet. We're still a few episodes away from getting to the second volume, but we will get there eventually.
I'm jealous. I need to pick up that second volume, too. The release surprised me. I was like, I'll pre-order it now. No, I'll wait till it comes out, and then all of a sudden it was here. And I'm like,
get it on your Christmas list, guys.
You know? There you go.
I haven't even gotten the first one yet, so imagine how jealous I am.
and folks, before we do get into this one, we mentioned this at the end of the last episode. If you are choosing to read this series along with us, well, at this point, it might be too late. But we did warn you, this story arc deals with some issues, not comic book issues, but societal issues and problems that can be triggering for some people and just difficult. We obviously will do our best to be sensitive about this topic. We're not going to dwell too much on the darkness of it, but it's germane to the story, so we'll mention it as we have to. But yeah, this one deals with child abuse specifically, sexual abuse specifically. We'll do our best to be sensitive about that, but knowing that in advance, if you're not aware, forewarned.
Be forewarned? Yeah. Be forewarned is to be forearmed, right?
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah. So on a more, regular topic, let's why don't we talk about the four covers. We are reviewing the story arc from Sandman Mystery Theater number 9 to 12, and the covers once again are all by Gavin Wilson, sort of this mixed media thing. So let's start with number 9. What did you guys think of number 9? Ryan, you want to start?
I like it, the cover. It's a city street with a person just sort of all in shadow. We don't really get a sense of the form of the person distinctly there. And that kind of almost sort of representative of a few images that we get in this issue in the series, particularly towards the end of it, really. I imagine this is the person that we don't see is meant to be the titular brute character. It evokes just sort of a loneliness because it's the only figure on the street, a sense of isolation, but also just the heavy darkness because we don't get any detail of just a silhouette, basically, just almost like a walking shadow.
I agree with Ryan. One of the things that I thought was interesting is these covers, and this cover is a good example of that, they're a little more straightforward than they were for the last storyline. The last the covers for the last storyline had overlays on image and colors and that sort of thing. And these are more kind of straightforward, high contrast photos with kind of like a duotone on top of it. Yeah. So they're a lot more straightforward, a lot easier to kind of see, which I thought was an interesting direction to take with it. And as Ryan was mentioning on this cover of number 9, it does do a good job of, that silhouette of our I don't even know if I would call the Brute the main antagonist at this point.
It's interesting. I anticipate, after reading the four issues, I interpret this character as a different character than the named Brute in the story, mm-hmm. but we'll get into that once we discuss the story. So
Yeah, totally. But you know, those squared off shoulders and the kind of the straight hair and you know, this sense of bulk of being large, you know, it really comes across in this cover. I like these covers quite a bit.
Yeah. The next one, number 10, is my favorite one. It's more iconic. It actually serves as the cover to the compendium. It's a shot of Wesley Dodds, the Sandman, in full trench coat and gas mask and fedora, climbing up a ladder and looking back at us with his gas gun in his hand. So this is very, you know, this is great. You know, you don't know, neither one of these stories, you know, doesn't tell you anything about what's happening in the story. They're definitely more poster oriented, but I really do like this. Definitely very mood evoking, as you were talking about, Max, and the duotone, you know, just sort of almost the black and white and the gray only makes it, you know, stand out. Would have stood out on the stands for sure.
Yeah, this is a classic. If you were going to get a Sandman Mystery Theater tattoo, this is what you would get.
Yeah, it's the hero shot. It's probably the best representative hero shot of all of the covers of the series,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I would imagine
at some of the later ones, but yeah, this is sort of big one, the hero shot.
It's not a surprise this is they picked the one for the cover of the compendium.
No.
And then the third cover on number 11, Max, Tim, why don't you give us your thoughts on that one?
Well, you know, this is a... It gives us the perspective of a boxer at the ropes of a boxing ring, and someone is on the ground behind him, and the boxer has his head down, not in victory, which I think is a very interesting kind of pose for them to choose. There isn't a crowd in the back; it's just these two fighters. Again, very evocative, very straightforward, and I kind of like, you know, as I mentioned before, that these are just kind of straight ahead photos, because I think it really kind of... And then we'll get into this as we go. It kind of really reflects the storytelling with this, with this arc.
I like the boxing angle too. I mean, that's an important part of this storyline. So it makes sense that it's on one of the covers. And then the last issue, number 12, the cover, you know, once you've read it, it's sort of a heartbreaking cover.
Yeah.
The little girl with a doll in her lap and she's bedraggled and, you know, we'll get into that, but it's sort of, you know, it's definitely, you know, that nothing good's happening at this time.
Right. The girl in the cover, I mean, she has a doll in her lap, but she doesn't look like she's being comforted by the doll.
No.
There's almost like a pathetic quality to it. Like, it's terrible, but because of the context that we know, like, this reminds me, this kind of evokes the idea of like a psychiatrist or a prosecutor on a witness stand, like, show me on the doll where the bad man touched you type of thing. That's like, okay. So, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So good group of covers. I think I agree with you, Max, that overall, I think this group is better and more, while it doesn't give away the storyline, it's they're definitely seemed more connected to the story. So, you know, so I guess they do their job, right? All right, so let's get into the storyline. Again, this is Sandman Mystery Theater, number 9 through 12, written, of course, by Matt Wagner. We have a new artist, and we'll talk about the art in a little bit. R.G. Taylor is his name, lettered by John Costanza, colored by Dave Horning, and edited by the legendary Karen Berger, as our friend Sean Ross would say. let's start off with issue number 9, The Brute, Act 1. Had a December 1993 cover date and on sale on October 13th, 1993. Wesley Dodds and Diane Belmont go on their first real date, and it goes really well. Certainly better than the unfortunate Brit, whose late-night intercourse with a prostitute is interrupted by a hulking, monstrous-looking person who beats the man to death. The next day, Wesley meets Arthur Riesling, a rich boxing promoter who wants Wes to invest in a scientific expedition to Antarctica. At one of Arthur's boxing matches, Charles Ramsey loses the fight and the money he was promised. Arthur guarantees Ramsey that he can make money if he takes part in an illegal fight. Ramsey is a single parent doing his best to care for his young daughter, Emily, who has tuberculosis. Ramsey can't afford the medicine she needs, but has too much pride and dignity to risk his boxing career fighting illegally. He tips off D.A. Belmont about Arthur's crooked fights. For this, some of Arthur's thugs jump Ramsey, but the Sandman drops in to save him. That is, until Riesling's men call in their reinforcements, the giant murderous Brute.
The next issue, issue 10, The Brute, Act 2, has a January 1994 cover date and an on-sale date of November 16th, 1993. The Sandman and Ramsey take a beating from the Brute, but manage to escape with their lives. Sandman warns Ramsey that Arthur Riesling's men will come after him again. Ramsey goes home to Emily and they flee from their apartment. Later, Diane goes to Wesley's house to tell him about an act of child abuse she witnessed that rattled her. Ramsey and Emily walk the streets with no money for a place to stay, food, or her badly needed medicine. A kindly old vagrant named Mr. Schenck offers to let them stay with him in a shack by the waterfront. Arthur Riesling orders his oldest son Dennis to find Ramsey and kill him. Then Arthur meets with Francesco Gamboni to buy a sizable amount of heroin.
Issue 11, The Brute, Act 3, has a February 1994 cover date and an on-sale date of December 28, 1993. Ramsey and Emily are staying at Schenck's shack. Ramsey gives his daughter the last of her medicine, promising that he'll find work so he can buy some more. Wes meets with Arthur again and gets the old man to invite him to an underground fight. Ramsey spends the whole day doing hard labor for hardly any wages. He goes to his old manager asking for a new fight, one that pays, only to learn that Arthur has had him blacklisted from boxing. But Ramsey overhears Arthur arranging an underground fight at his home. Diane has taken a new interest in children's charities and begins soliciting funds for the United Way. After securing a check from Wes, she calls Arthur Riesling, who invites her over to his house later. Wes arrives at Arthur's house, where he witnesses a bare-knuckle and then spike-knuckle boxing match. Ramsey sneaks onto the property, maybe hoping to rob the purse, maybe not, but Arthur's men catch him. They summon the Brute, who stomps on Ramsey's hand repeatedly. Desperate and mangled, Ramsey returns to the shack, where he discovers that Emily has been raped by Mr. Schenck.
Issue number 12, The Brute, Final Act, has a March 94 cover date and was on sale January 1994. Ramsey beats Schenck to death with a crowbar, a revenge that still doesn't feel harsh enough. Outside Arthur's house, Wesley witnesses Arthur's son Dennis taking care of the Brute, treating it like a dear child. After Wes leaves, Diane arrives to get a donation from Arthur. Instead, Arthur tries to rape her, but she fends him off and rushes to tell Wes what happened. The Sandman learns from Dennis Riesling that the Brute is his sister Maria, whose deformity was caused by years of neglect and abuse from their insane mother. Ramsey purchases a gun from an old friend. The Sandman tips off the cops and D.A. Belmont that something is going down at the Riesling estate. Arthur and Francesco Gamboni meet at his house, but Ramsey interrupts the drug deal by shooting their guards. Dennis and Maria show up, and he sicks the Brute on Ramsey. But Ramsey shoots Dennis. Then the Brute kills Ramsey. Then Gamboni shoots the Brute. Then Arthur shoots Gamboni. Then the Sandman gasses Arthur. Whew. Later, Wes and Diane share a carriage ride in the park. She tells him all about Arthur's plan and that an anonymous donor, the Sandman obviously, has used the drug money to set up a trust fund for Emily Ramsey. The end. Whew. We'll get to the storyline in a second, but why don't we start off with the art. So we have a new artist, R.G. Taylor. What do you guys think, sort of overall, about this effort? Ryan, what do you think?
I overall liked it. I thought it was fine. I didn't notice a significant drop in quality for the most part. I thought there were actually like a lot of sequences where I was like, that seems pretty close to Guy Davis, or at least in the same world. I think much closer to Guy Davis's than the art that we got in the previous story arc.
Right.
So I felt like it was more of a piece and felt kind of like the Sandman Mystery Theater art that I equate with the story. Mm-hmm. As the story went on, and maybe this was just deadlines, and we'll kind of get into the idea that R.G. Taylor did not draw a lot of comics. His worked kind of within the realm, within the medium, but he did a lot of other stuff. So he didn't have many monthly comic book assignments. And maybe that was an effect, because I think the detail starts dropping out, especially in backgrounds and stuff like that, as the story goes along. And some of the later issues almost to the point where I'm like, I don't really get a sense of the space, the physical location where they're at. Like when they're in the shack, and okay, it's a shack, there might not have to be a lot of details, but even the final shootout in Riesling's house, like I don't know what room they're in. I don't know, like, kind of where everybody is standing in position. And it just seems like that, I mean, the scene is already chaotic because of all the, the way the murders,
everybody's, you know, shooting on everybody top else, of each right? other.
Yeah. Yeah, almost Tarantino-esque, you'd think. Actually, for all we know, this was inspired by that because it came out a little bit after Reservoir Dogs and around Pulp Fiction, too. But I thought the art was good. It was solid. It started off a little bit stronger. Towards the end, I thought, okay, maybe the deadline is catching up and he's not putting as much into it as could.
Interesting point. How about you, Max? What do you think?
Well, yeah, I agree with everything that that Ryan is saying. I did enjoy this art more than the art from the previous one, which I had some problems with, if you remember.
John Watkiss. John Watkiss.
Yeah, John Watkiss, his artist. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like Watkiss, Taylor also had more of a career in fine art as he, you know, in his later years. But I do like this art better. As Ryan mentioned, it's closer to Guy Davis, which is never a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And also, and more importantly, I think he has a better handle than Watkiss did on facial expressions and body language. There are some, and we'll get to our favorite panels later, but there are some panels where, that I enjoy just because of the facial expressions. I think Taylor does a great job of that. And, I think that goes a long way in helping the characterization that's happening in this story.
Excellent.
And there are scenes, and there, I mean, this is a, I mean, on all levels, not just what we gave a warning about, but this is a brutal story. A lot of things happen, and you can kind of feel that physicality in the art, and I appreciated that as a reader.
Excellent. I'm not going to repeat what you guys said. I agree with it. I too liked it better than the Watkiss art. Not quite as much as Guy Davis. I had a note about the facial expressions too, Max. So second you there. I do think, you know, I found it interesting as it did get a little more claustrophobic near the end that you were talking about, Ryan. All the panels are outlined in black, and you know, at least the ones that I'm looking at here in the compendium, as opposed to a lot of the white outlines. So I think it was sort of drawing us in. And I don't know if that was a deliberate choice either by the artist or by the editor, Karen Berger, or what, but I found like I noticed it, and it made me feel like more tight. And so I think that was intentional by, you know, who made that choice. I don't know, but I think that was intentional. So now why don't we talk through each issue, and then we can talk about our favorite plot points and panels and stuff. And the first one, first scene is really when we get the date with Diane and Wes, which was, I thought, very lovely. It was nice to see them get together a little bit on a real date. And Diane's starting to get more interested in him now, which I think we can tell.
This Diane looks a lot like Guy Davis's Diane.
Yeah.
Wes is a little bit closer than how John Watkiss put him, but like this Diane looked as close as you can get to Guy Davis's Diane.
Yeah, that's right. Recognizable Diane as opposed to the, you know, the Watkiss interpretation. I agree with you.
Yeah, this is a very thin kind of Wes.
So was the other one too. So was the Watkiss one.
Yeah, exactly. But for some reason, it doesn't bother me here. It doesn't bother me as much. But yeah, I mean, this is, it's just so damn cute. You can see them falling in love.
Yeah, that's cute.
I like that a big part of their conversation on page 3 is them talking about music.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that.
His whole thing is like he likes jazz, but this new form of jazz is too much pop for the kids and everything. And it's just an excuse to dance, and it doesn't really have any meaning. But Wes really likes the new sound that's coming out of Chicago in the Deep South, which they call rhythm and blues. Whoa. What's this new kind of music?
Well, you know what? I was going to ask you guys. Okay, so what modern music do you think Wes would be into? I mean, if jazz was getting like a little too commercial for him, what would he listen to now?
Ryan's the expert on this. I don't know.
If not dubstep, then I mean, given gosh, would you think, like, would he be more into more sort of like transitive, like house music, something that would put him to sleep, or would he want something more bombastic to keep him awake, something more distracting?
See, I'm thinking like Fat Wreck Records punk. I think he just wants it raw.
It can be, yeah.
That's funny. Yeah, no, and I thought that was a lovely scene. So then we get the scene of the brute. We don't really know why the brute is there. There's a sailor and a prostitute, and the brute comes and kills the sailor, and the woman is sobbing as the brute goes away. Come back.
You know what? That was a good question. Why does that happen? I didn't realize it before, but it doesn't really add anything to the story.
It's our first glimpse of the brute, so we kind of figure, okay, there's this hulking, and I call her the brute for lack of a better word. It's Maria, but it's our first glimpse of her as an obvious threat, because when she shows up on the last page of this issue, we have to know who the heck this is, what's going on. In terms of why she attacks this rando person, this rando couple, kind of just like getting it on in like the middle, like on the docks or something like that, I think we kind of have to backfill from later on that she was in the car and got away from.
You're right. That's Dennis, right. She got Murphy, away.
Whoever was with, because they mention later on that she kind of like slips away and does some damage.
Yes, yes.
Is it an additive scene? I don't know how much it is. Is it necessary? No, it doesn't really mean anything to the overall plot. I do like the scene, though. It is one of my favorite parts of this particular issue, just because the violence is intense. It is kind of horrific to just have this scary stranger just show up. It's kind of, it's out of a horror movie. This is a couple about to have sex, just any Friday the 13th or Halloween type of movie. You know, the couple is doing this when they're at their most vulnerable. That's when the slasher comes in. And in this case, it's this monster who just starts beating this man to death and kicking him. And what capped it for me is, you know, the last couple shots when it's just a close up of the woman and she's like screaming as blood is kind of splattering her and she's shielding her eyes. And the panel at the top of page 7, she's curled up in the fetal position. And yeah, she just starts kind of repeating this phrase of hers where she's talking about, you know, she's a good girl. She's going to treat you right. Everything like that. It shows you like how this woman has obviously been traumatized before. She's been, because this is something that is common for them. A trauma victim will regress to a time when they felt safe or secure, and they will just start repeating these type of things and replaying that moment. So it shows that, like, this woman, even though she survived the stab, she wasn't physically altered. This shows that she is a victim of something. And it's also almost the identical scene that we're going to get when Ramsey finds his daughter at the end of issue 3, to the same thing where she's curled up in the fetal position, repeating the same phrase altered out. And it's just like, I'm going to come back to this again, but like sort of the overall theme of this story that we keep coming back to is that victims, in particular children, the way that children are abused and harmed and taken advantage of by the system, and the way they are, Max, you called it a brutal story. It's the way the innocent are brutalized by men, particularly in power, and the way they do things. But the first dream that Wesley has at the beginning of this issue is all about children being threatened by some imposing father figure type of thing. And we see that throughout, the way that children become so abused that they then become abusers themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, and we find out later that Maria, the brute, the nominal brute, it has been seriously abused. Before. She was locked in a closet for 3 years and all that kind of stuff.
We see the same thing from Dennis's, Arthur's young twin. Those twins have obviously gone through something because they sound like sociopaths, the way they talk to each other.
Yeah, repeat their father.
And then and then like when Diane, you know, I'm jumping ahead, but when she takes an interest in this boy who's getting slapped around by his mom in the street, the kid lashes out at Diane, and it's we see that this cycle of it is the cycle of violence that perpetuates, that turns these abused children into violent people themselves.
Right. And that is definitely a thread throughout this arc.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then we segue into the scene where Wes meets Arthur Riesling. He's first having a cup of coffee or tea or whatever with his friend, the judge. Mm-hmm. And Riesling meets him there at the restaurant or the club or wherever they are. And it's supposed to be this sort of more polite society type of thing, you know, and as we find out later, Riesling is quite a brute himself. And and he wants Wes to invest in his his Antarctica expeditions, which I found interesting. And Wes did too, because he's like, you know, this is a guy who promotes boxing, but then he also has a philanthropic, you know, side to him. So Wes is intrigued. I got to feel like it's more the Sandman side of Wes who's intrigued by this and wants to find out more. So he says, you know, okay, I'll come to your party on St. Patrick's Day, which is coming up.
I had to wonder if that was a, and this is probably just me, but I had to wonder if that was a reference in some way to Lovecraft and At the Mountains of Madness, because this would have been 1938, and that came out 2 years before, and then came out in 36. Okay. I just kind of wonder if this is some sort of, you know, some sort of little play by
It wouldn't surprise me, given Matt Wagner, it wouldn't surprise me if that is some kind of reference to it. I think ultimately, in terms of the plot, it's just he needs the money and he can say,
yeah,
the expedition literally went, or figuratively went south. You know, like something fell out and you can't get your money back because, like, you know, the crew was, you know, all died in Cape Horn or something like that.
Right. Well, and at the time, too, I mean, that was still, you know, an unconquered frontier. You know, we still had rich people. You know, funding and going on expeditions to Antarctica just to see if they could. So, yeah. So, I mean, that definitely fits in. Am I the only one who thinks that he looks a little bit like an older Henry Winkler?
Riesling?
Wow.
Yeah. He looks like he was modeled on Henry Winkler to me.
I guess I can see it in that on the bottom of page 8.
Mm-hmm.
The middle panel there. I can see it a little bit. I did not. It didn't jump out at me. But now that you say it, I can see it there. I can see it there, and I'll look for it as we get close-ups of him further on. So that's interesting. So then we get a quick two-page scene of what's his name, Ramsey, who is lost his fight. He doesn't get paid because of that, and the Riesling sees him in the corner and says, "Hey, you know, I'm interested in your welfare. Why wouldn't you be eating well? Maybe because you're using the money for something else, i.e. the medicine for his daughter." The Riesling knows where he's to turn the screws, you know? And he says, "I'm here to make you an offer. If you want to make some guaranteed dough, give me a call. I run a few unofficial bouts on the side." And we'll do a little discussion later about what this all means. But Ramsey does not want to do it because he could lose his boxing license, of course.
And he's an honorable man, and we'll see even how that plays even more. Even when he's desperate, I think he tries to do the right and honorable thing to make an example for his kid. The one thing about the boxing scene, when we actually get the boxing match, I think if this story arc came out later in this series, he would be fighting, if not Ted Grant, there would be a reference to Ted Grant in this scene. Because spoilers for, like, world building of the Golden Age heroes does expand beyond the Sandman as the series goes on. Yeah. So I think later on, Matt Wagner would have tied that into
it. Yeah. And then comes a very, very short scene with a couple of my favorite panels of the issue, starring Diane. So Diane, her father gets home working late. She's in his study reading his case files. And she's got this, got caught look on her face at the bottom of page 12. And she's quickly stuffs the stuff back in the father's safe. So I just love that. I love that about Diane. She's just reading her father's stuff and just getting away with it. So, "Hi, Daddy, I'm in here. I'll, you know," and she's putting the frame back on the wall so that he doesn't know. I just think that's terrific. And then from one father-daughter relationship, we go then to the next, which is where we find out that Ramsey's daughter, Emily, has tuberculosis and is very sick. And she's like, "I'm fine, Daddy, I'm fine." And he starts to reconsider maybe he should take Riesling up on his offer.
He's a desperate man. If he gets surefire money to pay for it, to help his daughter out, that would make sense. But
Wes asks Diane to go to the party with him. And that's where we meet Riesling's two younger sons, presumably from his latest marriage, however many he's had, who are wearing boxing gloves and sort of little outfits. And they're running through the house, like destroying stuff, like real terrors. But they're vicious little terrors, right? And they're beating on each other and knocking stuff over, you know. And even Wes is impressed by the wealth and the gaudiness of Riesling's home, which I found very interesting, because Wes is portrayed as, you know, very well to do, and he's impressed. Particularly, both he and Diane are are about on page 17 looking around at Riesling's house, and like Wes is like, my, my, my. And she says, and that's coming from you. Yeesh. What'd you guys think of these scenes?
Yeah. I love them. I mean, I thought these were very good at establishing our cast of characters for this arc. I think it did a wonderful job of kind of showing why Wes is like almost instantly suspicious of Riesling. For me, the biggest thing is just to see how Wes and Diane are kind of developing into partners now. And I really like kind of seeing that come together.
Well, Wes is, she's like, why are you, how well do you know this guy? And she's like, obviously you don't know him well. And he's like, yeah, I'm not sure I trust him. And he starts to say, I had a dream, but he says, I had a feeling that he's not to be trusted. And so this is where we find that. And so then we meet his other son, who's older, you know, and is an adult son, Dennis. And he says, oh yes, your father's new friend. And you could, like, if this was a movie, you could hear the quotation marks on friend, probably, right, because he knows this is where father's getting his money for the Antarctic expedition and other things.
Ironically, this storyline so far, and then it actually kind of holds through, has more of a Chinatown vibe than the last arc did. it has that vibe of the movie Chinatown.
Yeah.
I was asking myself, I was like, why do we need these two kids, these twin boys of his and everything like that? They don't really serve much to the plot. We kind of need Dennis, but I think it shows the pattern building. I mean, we meet them first, and it's like, okay, Riesling has these kids who are significantly younger than him. Right. He appears to be in his 60s, maybe, by the art, I would assume. And these kids, preteens, maybe just young teens, 10. Somewhere in that realm. Obviously, he had them from 10 or 11, a younger relationship. And then he has this adult son, Dennis, who comes off like a functioning alcoholic. But it's okay, if these are his kids, what kind of relationship does he have with them? Obviously, he has them. They're in his house. He has a relationship. It's like, but what kind of father is he to be producing people who behave this way in public and seem to have all of these kind of personality issues? That, again, is kind of tipping you off that, all right, there's something about this guy.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting because later on we'll see that he tries to present himself as a loving father, and it's obvious that he's not.
Right.
You know, just by the way these kids behave, and also what is his name? Dennis, the older son, just kind of drips with resentment for his father.
Yeah.
Right from the beginning. And so all sorts of alarm bells about Arthur Riesling are going off already.
Right. Mm-hmm. And here's yet another set of alarm bells is now we see the boxer that I didn't mention it, but while when D.A. Belmont got home and got a phone call, he says, yeah, I remember you. He was actually speaking to Ramsey, who said, hey, I got some dirt on Riesling. And this is where Ramsey tells Belmont that Riesling is running dirty fights and I don't want to be part of it. Unfortunately, he's been followed. And he stops to help a kid who a couple of Riesling's men have put him up to, you know, stopping Ramsey, and they start to beat him up. But the Sandman steps in, and they would have been fine, except for now we get the second appearance of the brute. And one of the guys blows a whistle and says, come and get him, baby. And then we see this monstrous hulking figure, the last page of the issue of the brute.
Yeah, this guy Murphy is like the head of Riesling's henchmen, his thugs, and he's the one who kind of uses the whistle to summon Maria / the brute. But you kind of mentioned it, like we have this these great contrasts, because here we see that Ramsey, okay, he could buy into Riesling's world. He's desperate. He needs this money to take care of his daughter, but is he willing to sell his soul? Is he willing to give up his honor and his dignity to provide for her? What kind of example is that for her? Would he be the man that she adores, the man that she looks up to, if he was able to take that shortcut? So he doesn't. He's like, no, I got...
He also could get really, really hurt, right?
Right. He's like, if I'm going to make my living in fighting, I've got to hold this up. And yeah, there's this kid on the street who's hurt and everything, twisted his ankle. And whereas we see Riesling and his family and all these people where they victimize children, Ramsey doesn't know this kid. but he sees a kid on the street and he's like, I'm going to help this guy or this kid. And he stops to help this child. And it turns out to be bait for a trap. And the kid was just luring him into this problem where Murphy and the other thugs start to beat him up.
Yep.
So just the contrast, we see that like Ramsey's a good guy. He's a natural father. He's a protector. He's the guy who fights to help people. And in a different world, he might have had a different type of life in this world. But yep. Yeah.
So that's the end of the first issue. We move to the second issue number 10. And we don't start right up with the fight. We get a 2-page scene of Diane coming out of the movies with a friend of hers. Do you guys know this movie, Bringing Up Baby? Did that come out in 1938? I assume it did.
It did. That's how I pegged the date. It was 1938. Mm-hmm. And I do know this movie. This is a I know what they're calling it. Just a screwball comedy.
Yeah.
With Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant and if I remember right, a leopard. I don't remember what kind of big cat baby is, but yes, it's a screwball comedy, which I'm kind of surprised to see Wes going to be honest.
No, it's not.
Oh,
Wes.
No, it's not Wes. Sorry. Yes.
Yeah, it's Diane's girlfriend. And you know, I think it's all back to what Ryan was talking about before, theme of kids. Diane's like, whoa, kids aren't for me, I'm not my thing. And because then they see the mother beating on her son, saying, what are you doing down here? She starts to beat him. Diane steps in and says, hey, stop hitting him. And, and then there's an altercation and the woman goes away. What'd you think of Diane once again trying to do the right thing?
I like this. I didn't like the way this scene was broken up in the story because it almost seems like there were like pages out of order. They're not because they're clearly numbered, but like, after this woman walks away, we cut back to the whole sequence with the fight in the alley between Ramsey and the Sandman and this other thing. And then we jump back to this one page thing of Diane taking care of this kid when the cop shows up. But then the kid kind of like lashes out and bites Diane's hand and he runs away. And Diane's friend is like, that's what you get for caring about people. And then we go back to the fight again. It's like, this almost feels like a mistake. Like this should have been ordered differently. Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. I think page 6 should have followed right after page 2 and then moved on with the rest of it. I think that would have improved the flow of the story. Yeah, sometimes whether it's the writer or the editor, they get a little too caught up in some of those things. I think they just I don't think they should have broken that up. I think it should have been one more page. But
I wonder if they were trying to contrast Diane's essential kind of struggle with a child and Wesley as a Sandman's struggle with a childlike person. But I whatever the reason, it breaks up the flow of both scenes, especially the fight scene for Sandman. And it's a great fight scene. We see Sandman really kind of on the ropes here.
Yeah, he's like, let's get out of here, man.
Yeah, let's get the hell out of here.
I can't take this brute.
Yeah. One thing I did like, though, is that it shows how Diane is becoming less and less of that socialite playgirl and more of someone who is noticing the things around her.
Yeah.
And wanting to do something about it. Right. And so I like the scene on those terms. But yeah, I agree with Ryan. I don't know why they decided to break it up the way they did.
Yep.
Right. Even going back to the end of the last issue, Wesley as the same man is having no trouble with Murphy and his goons. He's like throwing like garage or garbage can lids at them, like Captain America's shield, like discussing, knocking them out. And he's throwing other guys over his shoulder. But the Maria, as we'll see, she's throwing him into the wall. She knocks the gas gun out of him. And like, we'll find out later, like his ribs might be cracked. She's beating up Ramsey, who is a professional fighter. And I just love that. And like at the end of it, the way Sandman gets her, he throws a garbage can over her head and pops the gas gun inside it so that there's nowhere to escape from the gas. Like there's no other. So it's just like a full inhalation of it. Right. And she kind
and
of
even then away. They're like, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
I don't know how long that's going to hold.
It's a great fight scene. And there are a lot of good fight scenes in this arc.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but that one really brings it home about how, you know, just how strong and how dangerous the Maria, the brute, how dangerous she is.
Yep.
Because even when she hits Ramsey, like in Ryan's,
who's a professional boxer.
He hits him. I mean, he flips him around and then hits him. And Ramsey's on the ground, and all he can do is kind of lay there and go, Jesus, you know, and for a boxer to say that, you can, I mean, that tells you how hard he just got hit.
Right.
So then we get, Sandman drops off Ramsey in his apartment, and he gathers up his daughter and they take off because he knows that Riesling's after him. And then we get another one of my favorites, which is the, with a Diane and Wes conversations late at night at Wes's house. Mm-hmm. And she comes in. Wes goes into the secret garage. You know, he's got this second garage where he keeps the Sandman car. And he's clearly hurting. And he's like, and he has to make up a story to Diane. and she's like, well, I didn't see you come in. He's like, oh, well, we must have just missed each other. But they have this great scene where she went to it's really charming to see how Diane, when she's bothered by something, right, she goes and wants to talk to Wes about it. Doesn't matter the time of day. Doesn't, you know, it's clear, like you said, Mac, they're falling in love. It's just really a, despite all this crazy evil stuff happening around them, the two are connecting, which I find really terrific.
Right. I thought it was funny that, you know, Wes is really doubled over. He's holding on to his, what are probably cracked ribs.
Yep.
And, you know, and Diane shows up and he blames it on curry.
I had to think about this. I was like, this seems like a classic, like Clark Kent type of thing too. It's like, why do the heroes always blame gastrointestinal distress as an excuse and as a way of covering the fact that they've obviously just been in a fight? Okay. say you just fell down. You just fell down and you might have cracked a rib. It's not hard to believe, but it's like, sorry, just, you know, as an indigestion, Diane, I ate something spicy.
And I love that. As she's leaving, she gives him a hug. And you know, he's like, oh.
Yeah, she's like, take a bromo.
Take a bromo.
But this is one of my favorite scenes. Absolutely. Just like you said. I think it's one of the best drawn scenes. I love the art in the sequence. Like the way, again, talking about the facial expressions, but the body language, the way Wes is holding himself. Like you can see as he's sitting down how slow he must be sitting. He's like, okay. And that's when she noticed. She's like, okay, what happened? I have a story to tell you, but clearly there's something going on. Tell
him. Yeah. Right. Right. I mean, the exchange, you get a real insight into Wes, I think, on page 11, that I think is great. He says, you know, it's horrible. He says, when I was growing up in the Far East, I saw such scenes that were common. He saw a vendor break his son's arm for giving the wrong change to a customer. And then he says, and she's like, do you think I was out of line? He says, the world would be a better place if more people spoke up when they witnessed injustice. And that just, boom, it hits you right there. That's why he's the Sandman. And eventually that's why Diane's going to, you know, be his partner. So I agree. It's great art scene and it's just the best sort of personal interaction scene as well. So I really liked it. Yeah. We move on. We get some scenes at the home of Riesling. He's arranging the drug deal. The boys are battling each other, which is, you know, he just says boys will be boys, even though they're like cursing each other, banging, you know, I mean, they're just drag out fighting each other, which, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I love this little moment where once Arthur leaves, Dennis pushes one of the kids and then the kid turns around and he thinks his brother did it and instigates this fight between the brothers. Like, Dennis did that. Dennis started that. I was like, okay, this guy was like clearly such disdain for his whole family.
Yeah. Well, and what I like, and it's kind of dark, is when they come running in, when the twins come running in, they're, one of them is talking about how they caught a frog, but the other one killed it with a stick. Yeah. And, you know, and that to me is an interesting way to talk about this casual cruelty that must be going on in this house.
Yeah.
Because no one even mentions, he talks about it and there's no admonition about it. Nothing about like, oh, why did you do that? Or nothing like that. It's just like completely normal.
Yeah.
And it's disturbing in its own little way.
Yeah. Next thing out of his mouth is like, I'm hungry. I want lunch.
Yeah.
And again, and I mean, this isn't limited to the fiction and the comics that we see more and more of this, but an attribute of wealth is people's problems become theoretical. So they don't empathize them. Like, of course, it's just a frog. Who cares? And there's no consideration to this casual violence that he saw because who would complain and who cares who complains about it? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And which will go to the fights later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
The dream sequences didn't do as much for me in this arc as in previous arcs. We had one in the first issue. We have another one here on page 14. I don't know if you guys have a different theory. We get a bunch of heads of children in the snow. I get that it's about, you know, violence at children, but they didn't do as much for me. I don't know if you guys disagree.
Yeah, I kind of just felt like the children being buried by the snow, just by sort of like an inevitability, like an aspect of nature that you can't control, is that the children will just be swallowed up kind of by this world and the society and until there's no trace of them anymore. And
I think before, the dreams have this palpable sense of dread, and I didn't necessarily get that from these dream sequences.
Mm. Yeah. Maybe they're a little too...
Almost like too straightforward.
Esoteric, or yeah, okay. Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It's yeah. Okay. I mean, they're obviously very symbolic, but they, for some reason, they just don't have the same impact for me.
Yeah. So Wes is checking out Ramsey's apartment. Two guys of Riesling's are tossing the apartment. They realize that he's got a daughter. He's on the run, and then that leads us into an important scene where they're sort of on the wrong side of the tracks. There's, you know, homeless people with fires and trash cans and all kinds of stuff going on out and about. And they meet this, what appears to be a kindly gentleman named Mr. Shrink, who says, hey, you know, you're welcome to hang out with me in my abandoned shack that I've been squatting in. You know, and that at least gives them some shelter from the cold, because it is winter during this episode. And Emily is hacking and coughing. He says, you know, I'm cold, daddy. She's, you know, she's really in bad straits. And then a nice artistic touch is we see that Arthur is on a boat, one of the mobsters, the boat that it sails right under the bridge where presumably that's, you know, one of the New York bridges. And it's where, you know, the wrong side of the tracks where the shack and the other guys are. So contrasting the two worlds. Yeah. And Sandman doing his favorite thing, listening to their, I like this scene. This is the scene of Riesling. So Riesling is trying to buy a lot of heroin from the mob. And we don't know why. And he says, but you can't sell it in New York because the other mobs, the Chinese Tongs and the others have and he says, don't worry about it. I've got a plan for it. And we don't know what that is, which I found interesting.
I like the shot at the end with like the salmon, just like he obviously took a small little rowboat or a dinghy out to the larger ship. And he's just kind of like looking through the porthole and spying on them.
Yeah,
part of me, I couldn't help but think back to the first story that we talked about on this podcast, the very first appearance of the Sandman, that one at the World's Fair, when I was like, oh, man, I wish he had stripped down the jacket and just down to his pants and the gas mask and swam out there.
Yeah, that would have been a nice callback. Because, yeah, it's almost the exact same scene. He's hanging off an anchor line with his little listening device stuck to the side of the ship. But yeah, that would have lost opportunity. That would have been nice.
So, guys, tell me what you think of this next scene where we get the Sandman paying a visit to D.A. Belmont and Diane comes in on the conversation. What'd you think of that scene?
In not much time within the story, like, the Sandman, he's just part of their lives now.
Yeah.
And they just kind of almost have this, not quite a Commissioner Gordon relationship, but they're like, he's not rushing to call the police to get, like, Lieutenant Burke over there. Burke, who we haven't seen.
Haven't seen him for a while, yeah. Actually, I don't think he shows up in this arc, does he?
No, but yeah, it's like, okay, the same, it just comes to give us some information. We're just going to have a conversation. And like Diane walks in on it and he's just like, they're kind of like, we don't need to talk about this in front of the woman, but it's, I think that Wesley would be more about, I don't want her seeing this part of me as often because I don't want her to possibly, I think he knows that if she spent more time with the Sandman, she might be able to put it together.
She knows she's smart and together.
Right. Yeah. To be honest, in this scene, I almost thought it was going to end with her going, but it is a great scene. It does show one of my nitpicks about the art in this from this artist, and it's a realistic choice. But I personally do not like that you see so much of Wes's face behind the mask.
Yeah,
that you see his eyes and you see that sort of thing, and that really made me think, oh, Diane's going to recognize him you know, right away.
That's a good point. You're right, because they do show a lot of it on pages 21 and 22. You see a lot of his face. The eye holes are much bigger, which I think probably is what those masks really look like, because people have to be able to see out of
the It's probably accurate. Yes, I know. but for some reason, you know, it takes a little bit of the mystery out of Sandman Mystery Theater. But I do enjoy that scene. But yeah, I thought for sure Diane was going to figure it out.
Yeah. And then we end the issue with the bad guys finding the brute and getting the brute to go back into the truck that they've been driving around searching. That's how we find out that, like you said before, Ryan, the brute has been released.
Just for a sense of scale, you see Maria, you see the brute getting into the back of what looks kind of like, I don't know if it's like a delivery truck or just a large car, but, you know, I mean, how tall must she be? Maybe almost close to 7 feet from the look of
her? Yeah, gotta be.
Sure looks that way, yeah.
I mean, she is big. She is tall. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't think we've really talked. I mean, we've talked about how you know, her size, but she is, I don't want to use the word monstrous, but, you know, but she is.
That's the, okay, this, now we're getting way too overly scrutinizing thing, but yeah, if she is that tall, her coat would not come down that low, like past her knees. Like, they wouldn't make a jacket that long.
Right. That's a good point.
Especially back as 1938, like, I'm sure the average height for an adult was like at least an inch, if not more inches shorter than it is today. But like, yeah, it would be.
And they didn't have DXL then? I don't know. That's where I buy a lot of clothes. So anyway, I'll pick it up a little bit. We start off the next issue. Diane is asking the judge about what kind of charities she's thinking about maybe getting involved in children's work, which I thought was lovely. We see that Ramsey gives his daughter the last of the medicine and goes off to work for the day. And we end that scene, bottom of page 3, with what looks like a kindly, smile from the old man taking care of the daughter. You know, when you think back in retrospect, it becomes obviously much more disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
Wes then wrangles an invitation by talking about how he likes the brutal fights, and Riesling's more than happy to invite him to one of those fights. What'd you think of that? Wes sort of going undercover like that. That's like a Bruce Wayne thing to do too, right?
I like it because it's very subtle, but it kind of takes advantage of Riesling's racism. You know, because he's already used a bunch of, you know, racist remarks before this. You know, as we have seen, racism is a through line in these comics. And so Wes tells him, you know, that he kind of got into more brutal fights during his time overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Riesling just like jumps on that because, of course, you know, those people are savages, you know, is the sense that I got. You know, there is no hesitation from Riesling on believing that Wes would have been exposed to that somewhere else.
So then we end that scene with Dennis coming in saying, we've got a problem with Maria. Riesling doesn't want to talk about it at the office and actually slaps
Arthur slaps Dennis.
Yeah, Dennis. Arthur slaps Dennis, and Wes happens to see it. And the secretary's like, what you doing, guy? And he's like, oh, I forgot my hat. And off he goes. I like that little scene.
Especially since he's wearing it.
Yeah, I know. He's got it on his head. Mm-hmm. We see that Ramsey has worked and only gets $1.20 for 10 hours work.
The guy who's paying him, like the foreman or whatever, who's not paying him very much. Mm-hmm. This guy in just those two panels on the bottom of page 7, to me, I see Ed Asner with facial hair.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
Now I can't unsee that one either. That's funny.
I wasn't planning to, but it sounds like we're fan casting this.
Yeah, really. So Riesling goes and meets the mob and says, well, I need to extend the date. I'll get you your money, but I need a little more time. And for some reason they meet in Harlem or somewhere. I can't exactly where it is. And Riesling, you know, not happy about having to meet there, but it's a lot of cash, but I'll have it for you in a week. Again, Sandman is listening in, which is neat. And then, And then we
and I love how old school everything is. You know, it's just it's a microphone down the fireplace.
I love that little microphone beeping out of the fireplace. It's awesome. Yeah.
Where's Ralph Dibny with his elongated ears when you need it?
An important plot point 12 is when Ramses at the gym overhears Riesling talk to another fighter about illegal bouts. And that's where he has the idea. It's interesting that you said, Ryan, that his idea was to steal the money from the gate. I guess I didn't think of that, but it makes sense because he needs the money for the medicine. But it didn't occur to me. I guess I wasn't really sure, you know, what he was going to do. Yeah.
That was my first thought, was at this point, like he's just worked a full day and didn't get the money he needed. Mm-hmm. So he's even more desperate now. They don't have a home. Mm-hmm. What is he going to do? So my first thought was, okay, he knows this Riesling guy has been gunning for him. Like literally they're going to kill mm-hmm. him if they find him. So mm-hmm. no loyalty. I was like, all right, my first thought was, yeah, he's probably going to go there and like try and like steal the money. He knows all the money's going to be there and he mm-hmm. has no love for Arthur Riesling. Is that in character for him at this point? Is he that desperate? I was like, maybe he's going to get evidence, to get like actual proof of this, to show the DA. Mm-hmm. Does, you know, I'm not sure. What else? Like, is there another reason that he would be going there?
I don't know. So then we get, we see him creep in there. Again, I'm moving along. We see the fight. Wes is there. And then it gets really brutal. There's blood all over the place. Wes actually can't stomach it. I don't think that's an act. I know he wants to get out of there and start investigating as the Sandman, but I don't know that that's an act where you know, where Wes is like, I gotta go to the bathroom. What did you guys think? You think Wes was acting there?
I don't think so. I think if you're a person with a soul and scruples, like this is profoundly upsetting to watch. Mm-hmm. And I evoked Tarantino's name earlier. If you've mm-hmm. seen the movie Django Unchained, there is a sequence where Leonardo DiCaprio's despicable character orchestrates these Mandingo fights between two people mm-hmm. that just fight to the death. And you see, as this is going on, Christoph Waltz's character, who is going undercover, pretending he's going to buy one of these people. And you can see how disturbed he is. Like he doesn't want to watch this, but he's like, I need to present myself like this is some kind of fight that I'm into, that this excites me or something like that. And it's like, yeah. And Wes is kind of in the same position here where he's like, oh yeah, this mm-hmm. is the kind of fight that I'm into. And he's like, I cannot watch these men literally.
Yeah. Middle of page 20, they're putting on their spiked gloves and Riesling's like, hey, now comes the good part, Dodds. And he's like, yeah, so I see goody. I like the goody just thrown in there.
And those aren't just, they're not gloves with just like spikes on the knuckles or, I mean, these are going up to the middle of the arm with spikes all over them. And there's a scene on the next page where one of the boxers hits the other one, you know, square in the face, and Wes says his jaw, you know. And so, yeah, I agree. I think Wes is affected by this. I think the blood sport of it is disturbing to him.
So then Ramsey's mm-hmm. caught. He's sneaking around. They whistle the Maria over, and she stomps on his hand. And apparently he gets away. He gets away and runs back. And Wesley's, I hear Wesley's like, oh, thank God for the night air, because he's like ready to throw up. But then he sees the brute go away, and now he knows for sure that Riesling's connected to the brute, which is good for him to know. But Ramsey goes running back to the shack. His hand is torn up. And he sees the girl in a fetal position with blood, and he realizes what's happened.
His first thought is she's having her first period, and she's like, no, you're not old enough for that, because he sees the blood down there. And then she's again, in this sort of traumatized idea, she starts talking about how Mr. Schenck gave her the new medicine, and she doesn't like it. He gave it to her down there, and she kept asking him to stop, and she just kind of almost goes catatonic in this kind of state. And you just see him on his knees next to her. And whatever pain he was feeling in agony from his hand, you just know that he doesn't feel that anymore. There's something completely, a new kind of pain obliterates that.
Yep.
And it's...
And like, rage, you know, and he's...
Yeah. And I mean, God, I read this story late teens, maybe I was 20 the first time I read this particular story. And I was disgusted then. I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. Reading it now as a father.
Yes.
It's like, this punches you in the stomach. Like,
absolutely.
It's terrible. Prior to this, our whole image of this Schenck guy was this kindly old father figure who kind of takes them in. He's like, hey, I've been on the street. I had a cousin or a friend with tuberculosis, so I know what you're going through. Come stay with me. I'll take care of her. You know, Ramsey's going out to get food. And he's like, yeah, leave her with me. I'll keep her safe. I'll protect her here so she's not alone. Fundamental betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
But also just like the betrayal of adults and society to betray a child like this. That again goes through the heart of this story, what this is all about.
Yep.
But it's just so brutal, as you said, Max. It's like, Jesus, Matt Wagner. I get it, but we're only in the third story arc, man.
Yeah. The good news, though, is that when we start the next issue, Mr. Schenck is done away with in the first two pages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we can call that.
He gives him the Jason Todd treatment.
Yeah, he's got the tire iron. He's like, I don't know what that little girl's been telling you, but she's lying. Honest, brother, I swear. And he says, who said anything about Emily? And he just, beats him.
Right.
And he's got blood on himself on the floor. It's just a real mess. Anyway, let's get back. Then we go back.
And it's interesting that is the title page on the last act, like the brute.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a shot of him under the street light, just standing there over this thing. It's like, and Paul, I know you're going to ask the question, who is the brute of this story? Because it kind of seems like it leapfrogs to different
answers.
Characters throughout
many
the story. And at this point, Aaron Ramsey, the most noble, honorable person we've seen in this story yet, has just murdered a man in cold blood. Has the world brought him to this point where he is now a brute?
Well, and what does that say about us as readers, if I can get a little esoteric here? Because I personally, I'm on Ramsey's side.
Sure.
And so, you know, I do not feel sorry for Schenck getting it at all. He got less than he deserved, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, are we all brutes? Or do we all have the potential to be brutes in this society? Mm-hmm. You know, it's an interesting question. I struggle with this plot line just because I'm not entirely convinced it's necessary, but I understand in the sense that, you know, if Emily had just died, Ramsey would probably still do what we see that he's about to do, you know, not with Schenck, but just with Riesling and everything else. That could have still happened. Was it necessary for her to be brutalized in this way?
Yeah, I don't know about necessary, but I think thematically, right, it's all about one person abusing another in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And as Ryan said, particularly with children, might as well talk about now in terms of the brute, right? We've got all these different candidates for the brute. We've got Riesling. We've got Ramsey, who was just, we've got Schenck, who's maybe done the most brutal thing of all. We've got, we've got the brute herself, but she's a victim too, because.
Right. We'll find that out in the next scene.
We'll find that out in the next scene that she's been a victim. She was, you know, we've got, there's just so many choices of who is the real brute of the story. You know, I mean, I just rattled off. We've got Maria, who's in some ways attentively Ramsey, the people watching the fights, right? The people getting off on the spiked glove fights, you know, the mother who's beating her kids, as well as the mother who stuffed Maria in the closet for 3 years, right? Recently, of course, and then the list just goes on in terms of the brute. I think, you know, the person most contributing to, you know, the brutalism in the story is Riesling, Arthur Riesling himself. He's created, what do you call it? A culture of what do you call it, Ryan? A
cycle of violence.
A cycle of violence, culture of violence
from him, sort of
perpetuates from him
down.
And your family. and that, you know, he's encouraged that both in his home and in his business, right? Mm-hmm. And so
and in his social circle, you know, Ryan had mentioned it before. You know, all the people who go to that bare knuckle fight are, you know, rich, mm-hmm. powerful people. Right. You know, it's not ordinary. Or the ordinary people are the ones in the ring. Right. They're the ones fighting for their lives, literally. And these people see it as entertainment, you know? So it's part of this whole, you know, I think Brian had mentioned before, but it's kind of a societal thing where mm-hmm. this violence, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean anything at a certain point to some of these people.
To both of you, the points, like Paul, I think like you're right. Like that, if we look at it almost as a family tree, like that, Arthur is sort of like the rotten root, and it just kind of like spiders off, and his kids are violent brutes in themselves. Like they all kind of like turn into that. But to your question, Max, about is the treatment that Emily gets in the story necessary to the plot? No, but this is a crime noir story, mm-hmm. and noir typically deals with a nihilistic worldview.
Right.
That maybe our heroes live in a world of grays, but most things are corrupt and black, and nobody is spared. Nobody gets out unscathed.
It does make sense in a thematic way, as you were mentioning, because this is an escalation of what the violence we've already seen being committed to children.
Yeah. And because they are the most vulnerable, they are the most innocent, and the brute, Paul, I think, is the world, this society.
That's a good
like one. To borrow the cliche, the evil that men do, but it's kind of just like the corruption of the elite and the powerful, and in particular the men of this and the rich men, and the way they victimize the poor and the wanton and the needy and
the vulnerable,
is more emblematic of that than a sick little girl. Mm-hmm. And she's not spared their wrath, their brutality. Mm-hmm. It's tragic. Okay. It's horrifying.
Yes.
But it's kind of the point of the story. And you can't not look at it in this case.
Right. And like you mentioned, you know, Riesling is at the heart of a lot of this. You know, it's and Paul, you know, we see that in the next scene with Diane.
Yeah. Now that's a good segue. The next scene, we see Diane calling on him to get a donation for the United Way. Most of the servants have the day off, he tells her. Mm-hmm. And he goes in, gets some tea from the cook. They go into his study and he locks the door behind there. And he starts, you know, he puts his hand on her leg and we don't need to go into details, but she's able to fight him off. And he's like, "What?" And he just feels very entitled to, "Come on, my dear, you're no nun, I can tell. Why else does a woman go to a man's house and unescorted? My, you do have such lovely, firm breasts." And he's just like, just a real sleazeball.
He's a creep, yeah.
And Diane is able to battle him off. She gets out of the house and runs away. Meanwhile, the two boys...
I was going to say, don't skip the detail. She knees him in the balls.
Yes, she does. Good for Diane.
That was nice. That was a relief.
After he tries to choke her. This is violent real fast.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very violent. And meanwhile, the two little boys are watching, one standing on the shoulder of the other, watching their father's thing. This is how you are supposed to act, treat women and other people.
Right. And they're expecting to see...
Yes,
sexual act. He doesn't say.
He must have seen it before,
right? They're like, "I want to see them f," and then like the rest of the word is cut off. But you know what they're going to. This is what they're. And there's a line earlier. I don't remember exactly what issue is it, but there's a moment where Dennis kind of. Your problem has always been like impulse control when he's talking about his dad. He's talking to his dad like impulse. It's like, oh yeah, this is certainly something that Arthur Riesling has done. This is probably how he ends up with all of these kids.
Yeah. He's obviously a serial rapist.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Yeah,
no question of that.
God, he's terrible. He is probably the worst, you know, person that we have seen so far in these comics.
So then we get a scene, and I'm going to treat this as all one scene. Again, it's split up by a page in between, but. We get a scene where Diane goes to Wes. She's very upset, obviously, by what's happened. And Wes is beside himself. That son of a bitch, he says. I knew he was capable, but I never dreamed that, you. And he said, if only I'd done something earlier. And he's really upset. She kisses him and she's amenable to it. And he's like, you know what? No, I don't want this to happen on this night. I want this to be a positive experience. And so she goes home, which is a nice way for them to have that interaction. So what'd you guys think of this scene? That was probably not as lighthearted, but also an equally as good Diane/Wes scene that I liked in this issue as well.
They already have this, they've already been on a date, and Max, you were looking like how they're falling in love. But yeah, like when she is almost a rape victim herself, when this horrible thing almost happens to her, she doesn't run to her dad, who's a freaking district attorney.
Yep.
She runs to Wes.
Yep.
And in explaining this situation and going through this grief and seeing his rage and all of this, like the lashing out, the protectiveness he feels toward her, hurts her. This is where they have their first kiss.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy, but it's like, this is what the series has been building up to at this point. It's like,
yeah,
when she's,
and I love Wes.
She's in danger, mm-hmm. who does she go to? She goes to Wes. Mm-hmm. She might not know all the way that he's the Sandman yet, but I do think there's something mm-hmm. from the beginning. She was drawn to him because there's something about him. There's something, a mystery about him, a behavior. There's something subliminal, subconscious in her that knows what he is.
Something mm-hmm. heroic, I think she recognizes. And one thing that I love about this exchange between the two of them is that it's the next step in their relationship. You know, they're not just, meeting at these parties or, having lunch or whatever. Mm-hmm. This is becoming a relationship.
Yeah.
And it's a relationship that is being built on mutual respect.
Right.
And I think that is so important to this couple, to these characters. And I love that Wagner is taking his time with it.
Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's great. It's great. He's like, it's just as well that you don't say, I have some unfinished business to wrap up. You know that what that means. He's going to go after him. Meanwhile, we see in the middle of all this that Ramsey has bought a gun because his daughter is clearly traumatized. I don't want any more medicine, Daddy. I don't want that medicine anymore. And Ramsey's like, I need to protect my little girl. Yeah. Now we get to those scenes in the black border that I was talking about before where, Wes goes back out to the estate. He's got like a bigger version of the gun, the gas gun.
Right. He's got a gas rifle now.
He's got a gas rifle. He says, pleasant dreams, gentle brute. And that's when we get Dennis comes in, that's when we get the story. She was born quite abnormal and beautiful little girl. Her only problem was being born illegitimate like me. And he says, but your father's a widower. Father always had a consumptive taste for women. And then he left to go abroad, and the mother went insane and stuffed Maria in the closet. I mean, oof.
For years.
I mean, just, mm-hmm. That really gets you, right? A different kind of abuse of a child. He says Maria stayed in that closet for almost 3 years. And so you can tell that, there's a reason he's sort of withdrawn from the world. He hasn't embraced the brutality and the stuff, but he doesn't know how to escape it. And he has his own form of escapism. So he's kind of a tragic, pathetic figure in this storyline.
Dennis's biggest sin seems to be that he's just weak.
Yeah.
But that is, I think, comes from probably a lifetime of abuse at the hands of his father. Mm-hmm. Probably physical, definitely psychological. And just trying to care for his sister. Yeah, I mean, who wouldn't become a functioning alcoholic, living that kind of life? But he obviously loves Maria. And, this is... like a lot of Sandman stories, just gearing up to become a tragedy, mm-hmm. and that's part of what makes it so tragic, is that these are people who some of them were not capable of, but there is these are people who in some ways were denied love, And this is the result of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then we cut back to the white border. So not at the estate. We're back at the Belmont home, and Diane and her dad are enjoying a quiet night at home. And she says, oh, that's just what I could do. And D.A. gets a call saying there's a shakedown going on down the Riesling estate. And yes, I want to be in on it. And he runs out. And Diane follows him in a taxi, which I love. She's like, follow that car. I'm like, you go, Diane.
I love it. She tells the cabbie, follow that police car, but don't be too obvious. And the cabbie's like, really? No kidding? Wow. but he picks up the phone. He's like, oh, hey, Ross, the Captain Ross. He's like, what? A tip from the Sandman? But this vigilante that they were chasing before. Yeah, he's just calling in tips.
So then we get the several pages of tragic shooting. You've got Ramsey has come in. The drugs are there, the money's there, and he's shooting all the people involved. He's going to shoot Riesling. Sandman says, hey, put your weapon down. Don't throw away. He says, you don't understand what they did. And but then who we just felt sorry for, the brother, calls Maria back in to beat up on Ramsey, and they basically all kill each other. It's just horrible. Yeah. And Sam and Wesley just kind of looks down at all the carnage. There's bodies everywhere. The only one left living is Emily, and she's
Arthur. The person we hate the most survives all the shooting and is just gassed and knocked unconscious.
That's right. Yeah, Arthur. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And then we get to wrap up all the police cars are there, the taxi's there, and Sandman gives Emily to Diane. She says, this girl is a victim of evil rot. Please find that she sees proper care. And then we find out that, he also, makes the donation of that, drug money to put in trust for Emily to for the rest of her life. Fortunately, there's a little bit of a lighter ending, which feels slightly out of place, but I guess you need it to have an upbeat ending to a story like this, where they're taking a ride in the park and we get a smooch from them at the end, which is kind of sweet. But
the reason I was kind of wondering, I was like, when Ramsey is sneaking around, was he going to rob the fight or something like that? Or possibly maybe he was just going to try and get actual proof or evidence that he could use to take Riesling down or protect himself. But I was like, has he been driven to that point yet? But clearly by now he has. He's already murdered a man who raped his daughter. Like, he's to the point where he's showing up to their house with a gun and he's willing to, he shoots these guards and everything like that. And he's going to take his revenge and he's going to take the money. And to be driven to that point of him as a character from what we thought of him at the beginning, and then just such a sad and pathetic death that he gets to, where he's like, he starts to shoot the guys, and then the gun, this cheap old gun that was in, like, that he got from this guy, just explodes in his hand, blows up his one good hand. Yeah. And then Maria just grabs him and, like, snaps his neck so effortlessly, almost like tosses him upside down. Like from the art of it, it almost looks like she just throws him up and he breaks his neck on the ground when she tosses him. So it's just, but again, it's the rich and powerful guy survives this. He might end up in jail, but if there was why didn't one of these bullets find him?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And the bullets are flying in that.
The bullets are definitely flying. Yeah. But like I said, a nice ending. And he says, Diane says, oh, police can't really prove it's the money from that night. So, and Wes says, what a clever fellow the Sandman is. And she said, yeah, I thought you'd like that. He says, in fact, it sounds like just the sort of unassuming thing you might do yourself. So I thought that was just cute. But so that's a nice way to end such a difficult story, for sure.
Well, I do want to say one thing to kind of wrap up my feelings on the storyline is that it is a tough read. It is a very hard read. And, like the content warning that we gave at the beginning, this is something that if this is any way something that will affect you, you should not read. I would, say to avoid it just because there are triggers all over this thing. That said, I do think that this is probably the best written storyline so far. And I actually except for the content, which is hard, I actually really enjoyed reading this story. I mean, like Ryan said, this is some classic hard-edged noir.
It's certainly very well constructed. I agree with you. The story itself,
yeah, and it's the sort of noir that I personally am really into. You know, it's brutal. It's tough.
I'm there with you because I was thinking after I read this one, I was like, okay, it's a gut punch, but I was like, I definitely liked it more than The Face and The Laster. Mm-hmm. I was like,
yeah,
and I might have liked it more than The Tarantula. I mean, that opening story arc was really good, but. Mm-hmm. We're building off of that now. We're getting more advancement with Wesley and Diane. We're seeing more of their characters, so that is fun. There's mm-hmm. a little bit more of enjoyment of seeing them, which gives a little bit of balance to the other parts. So, yeah, I do think this was well-written and potentially the best of the three so far.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And back to the art, I remember one of the things that was difficult for me in The Face was that it was hard to tell some of the characters apart. Yeah. And I didn't feel that at all. I knew who all the characters were in mm-hmm. this. Even in my old and adult state, I can't remember their names all the time. I could tell who, and I knew who all the characters were. I knew who Arthur Riesling mm-hmm. was, and his older son, and then the other kids. So I knew who all the characters were. So I was able to understand their actions, and that mm-hmm. certainly helped. And so, yeah, no, I agree with you.
But
any final? Yeah.
I was going to say, listeners, if this was a tough read for you, and if you skipped this one, just know the next story arc has lesbians, so that'll be a lot more fun.
but last thoughts on this storyline. I do want to talk to our listeners. You know, we've talked a lot around the edges of this unlicensed boxing, and me being who I am, I did a little research. It was suggested by Ryan, but you know, boxing as it is, as we know it today, had been banned in the state of New York from 1917 to 1920. And then there was something in 1920 called the Walker Law, which re-legalized the sport, but mandated strict regulation. There had to be medical staff, 15 round limits. They were licensing. They had to be, the venues would, you had to have proper arenas and so forth. But there was a loophole in the earlier legislation that did allow fights to take place inside, quote, athletic clubs. And so some bars would hastily designate themselves as clubs to host matches, a practice depicted in the painting Stag at Sharky's, which I found during my inner search. And it shows a scene in a saloon turned club on Columbus Avenue in New York. It was owned by a heavyweight fighter, Sailor Tom Sharky, and it's the setting of this raw 1909 painting by George Bellows. He was part of a school of artists bent on depicting realistic, gritty scenes of daily life. And we'll make sure to include a link to the image in the show notes, but it was really evocative of this story, and I thought it was worth pointing out. A couple quick notes of some other practices depicted in the story. You know, there were speakeasies, obviously, during Prohibition and Depression era. They became venues leveraging their secret location. So that was pretty, logical. Organized crime was heavily involved, betting. And the fighters were lower-level boxers who couldn't secure a license would participate in these unsanctioned matches. So for some, the allure of a quick, risky payday was enough to entice them. So we pretty much saw all that stuff in this story, right? With the possible exception of Riesling actually hosting the event at his estate. Usually they seem to happen in more seedy places than that. But, you know, he was rich enough that, you know, presumably he had enough cops on the take that, I'd allow for artistic license there. So anyway, I just thought we'd give a little background on some of those things that give a little context to the story, which, given that, seemed pretty authentic from that, mm-hmm. you know, the crazy events happening, but authentic from the point of view of the storytellers.
Are you guys into boxing? I know that when I grew up, boxing was very much a thing. You know, that was the era of Roberto Duran and Sugar Ray Leonard. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is, this was Muhammad Ali was still a household name and that sort of thing. And so I know that I grew up in a household where we watched boxing, professional boxing, and then, you know, later like Olympic boxing and that sort of thing. I've kind of gotten away from it. for whatever reason. I haven't really watched a boxing match in a really long time. But I'm wondering what your guys' experience was with that.
I never really was a follower of it. I know that I probably have watched a little bit of Olympic boxing myself, but I, not in the last, 20 or 30 years. I remember when I was a kid, when pay-per-view first became a thing, I remember my dad having gotten tickets, and I was, I think, too young to go, but it was like a closed caption. It was probably a Muhammad Ali fight, you know, maybe one of the Ali Foreman fights, where they would broadcast the fight into a local place. It was, closed caption TV set. And I know that, but that's really it for me. So I don't know. How about you, Ryan?
I remember when I was younger, I was like, we got pay-per-view at one point to watch, to see a Mike Tyson fight.
Mm.
I don't know who the challenger was, but it was one of his like first really big fights. That was kind of the, I think the fact that it always seemed like the fights were pay-per-view and it was like, it was just harder to watch. They weren't broadcast the way, at least when I was growing up, the way other major sports were. So it was harder to follow. Mm-hmm. I did sort of in college, I would find like YouTube videos, like archive footage of old boxing matches. And sometimes as a sport, it's always been something where I've appreciated the romance of it. And maybe because I think there's something where I think boxing and baseball as sports lend themselves greatly to narratives and movies. I think some of the best, like, that's why I think the best sports movies tend to be either baseball or boxing based. Like, obviously, the Rocky movies, also the Creed movies. I love what Ryan Coogler ended up doing, taking the Rocky franchise with Creed. But I just think, like, part of it is like the individual achievement, the individual accomplishment, because even with baseball, it's a team sport, but all of the accomplishments are, the measurables are done by individual achievements, individual feats. It's one person hitting the ball, one person catching the ball, one person throwing the ball, one person running the base. So all of those things lend themselves to a character and a character arc and their story. And I think boxing is very similar that way. Mm-hmm. So while I haven't really followed or watched a ton of boxing matches, it's always been something that I've liked from a distance because the romance of the narrative I can build around it in the lore.
But I do agree, Max, that it was much more of a thing when we were younger. Like, it was much more in the zeitgeist of the world. It was more of a popular sport, right? I mean, I think about like when my dad was growing up or whatever, I mean, everybody, all they cared about was baseball, right? But and now that's different, you know, and it's football and it's, you know, and so things change. And I do think it has fallen out of favor with a pretty sizable chunk of the, you know, sport viewing public.
And I think you guys make good points. And I think the pay-per-view probably had a lot to do.
I think so too.
Also. Yeah. So that's interesting. That's interesting.
When Ryan was talking about pay-per-view, just to give a funny, what I think of, what went to my head is it was, oh yeah, the pay-per-view probably contributed to killing it because they got greedy for the money.
Right.
But then I remembered, you know, it used to be they were fights like on the radio, right? And when I thought about fights on the radio, you think of like, Daredevil's dad and all the rest. But I also think of the ride at Disney World where the grandmother in the Carousel of Progress is listen, when the grandfather falls asleep, she turns the radio to the fights.
Oh, wow.
So that's a deep cut for those.
Yeah, wow. Wow.
That's like my wife's favorite ride and nobody else's. So if anybody has been on the Carousel of Progress, you'll know what I'm talking about.
That's so funny. Well, one more thing. I know we're trying to wrap this up, but I just also want to give a shout out to David Hornung. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. The colorist. Mm. He's been the colorist since the beginning. I think he's been the colorist for this for the entire series so far. But man, his colors are just gorgeous in this arc. I think he just does he's really coming into his own with what he's doing, especially in issue 11, page 1 and 2, when Diane is in the park. We get blue skies and we get the green of the park, and there's on page 2 there's a panel of Ramsey in the you know, in the ramshackle part of town. Mm-hmm. And the coloring of the sky with the clouds, you know, there's blue and there's white and there's gray. I think it's just, you know, it's, you know, so much work was put into this. And if you flip to page 4, you'll mm-hmm. see the sky of, it looks probably like it's sunset. Mm-hmm. So you get those pinks and golds and, you know, and it's just, you know, it's prettier than it has any right to be.
Yeah. You know? Well, I bet that's probably a choice too of, mm-hmm. I'm not always a good connoisseur of the colorist. So that's, I'm glad you called that out, Max. That's great. All right. So we're going to take a quick break for some promos. We'll come back and do listener feedback and the dream sequence. So hang in there.
Hey, folks, I want to tell you about Magazines and Monsters, a podcast that's dedicated to comic books as well as classic horror and sci-fi films. This podcast channel contains a bunch of shows like the Bronze Age of Horror Comics, a podcast that's, well, it's about Bronze Age horror comics. There's also The Brave and the Bob, a show celebrating Volume 1 of The Brave and the Bold from DC Comics and all things Bob Haney. But hey, let's not forget the main show itself, Magazines and Monsters, which rotates between old-school horror and sci-fi films with a heavy emphasis on the British studios Hammer and Amicus. Plus, you'll get a selection of episodes about comic books ranging from DC to Marvel and everything in between. So join your host Billy D and a few of his favorite friends for a fun and positive look at his two favorite pastimes. Find Magazines and Monsters now on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's 1986. The Masters of Evil have a plan to crush the Avengers. They succeed. Can our heroes fight their way back to victory and defeat the Masters? Join me, Tim Price, and an assemblage of some of Earth's mightiest podcasters as we cover Avengers Under Siege, issue by issue, plus tie-ins, celebrating the 40th anniversary of the greatest Avengers story ever. The show, Outcasters Under Siege, coming in 2026. Point your podcatcher to the Right On Network.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We're going to do some listener feedback now and then to the dream sequence. So first up in listener feedback from this very network, Chris Franklin said, the face looks like a twisted Mr. Potato Head on that last cover. Yeesh. Just from these sample pages, I like the art style better than Davis. I know. You're in a minority there, Chris, but you like what you like. It's all right. He said, I remember Watkiss drawing an arc of Legends of the Dark Knight about werewolves that was kind of hard to follow, so I get the complaints. His style reminds me a bit of Cliff Chang or Steve Yeol, who did some Starman work a bit after this. All right, fair enough.
You know, and Chris is a professional artist, so yeah. You know, I'll give that a You know, I'll give it the weight, even though I don't agree. So, Comic Foil says, I was not a fan of John Watkiss's art the first time I read these four issues, and I still wasn't impressed my second time. But the third, when I binged the whole series, I started to come around and realize it's not that bad. Now, after listening to your podcast covering the face issues of Sandman Mystery Theater, I realize there is a bit more to appreciate about Watkiss's style, and I'm going to start reading along with you all, even though the wait between episodes is interminably long.
Noah Tarnow said, count me among those who think that Guy Davis's art is perfect for the series, despite appearing ugly at first blush, but it added a great deal to my enjoyment of Sandman Mystery Theater during its initial run. Its unconventionality seemed well-suited to the gritty, realistic subject matter. I loved how Wagner made Wes and Diane wholly sexual people without the need for the art to depict them as the types of marble-carved deities that seemed to dominate comics from the 90s, or really any other decade. I'd forgotten that Davis did only some of the series. My memory was that he'd drawn, if not every issue, certainly the vast majority. Yeah, I looked at it the last time. I think he does about 2/3 of the series. I think it's 70 issues, and I think he does 44 or 48 of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think we talked about that maybe in the for the first arc, but it was the same thing for me. I could have sworn Guy Davis had drawn the whole thing, but
well, good news is we get him next time, so that's good. Next up, Grand Poobah, the Fire and Water Network. Rob Kelly said along those same lines, "I don't think I knew that the different story arcs were drawn by different artists. I really like the work of Wagner and Watkus in the pages you posted." So okay, good, another guy who knows his thing. Telling us to shut our mouths. Go ahead.
Dave Tomko says, "I didn't enjoy the face quite as much as the first story arc, but I completely agree with the highlights you mentioned. The relationship between Diane and Jimmy is easily the most compelling aspect. Shifting the focus from Wesley to Diane really lets her shine as the protagonist and detective. And if the reader doesn't pick up on that stuff, Wagner drives it home with those great lines you quoted. Quote, like some vigilante debutante. And quote, you make it sound like I'm the Sandwoman. He sets them up beautifully to be a dynamic team in future arcs." That is a great line. Vigilante debutante. That's got to be a band name waiting to happen. "The rest of the story feels like it has all the right elements for something great, but the execution falls a little flat. It seems Wagner was aiming for a theme around identity, both literal faces and the immigrant experience. But as you pointed out, the ending muddies that message. As for the art, John Watkus was still early in his career here. It looks like he may have been working from Guy Davis's style as a guide, but you can tell he struggled to make Wesley and Diane resemble their previous portrayals while developing his own voice. If you check out his work years later on the 2009 Dead Man series from Vertigo, you'll see a big improvement in how he renders distinct, recognizable characters. But at this point, it's often hard to tell who's who, which doesn't help, especially in a story involving characters wearing multiple faces."
I think I read that 2009 Dead Man series, but maybe not. I don't really remember it. Dr. Ainge said, "I like learning more about Diane from this story. As you say, she is pretty liberal and free-spirited for the time. That makes her pairing with Wesley so interesting. The timid, quiet guy would seem not her type if you didn't know about his Sandman. The ultimate bad guy is too much out of nowhere, and his plot does seem a bit too complex for what he was trying to do. But his weapon, the face, is terrifying, especially when in full Gollum mode, talking in the third person and being bananas."
Next up, Tim Price weighs in. He says, "Phew. This is clearly a Vertigo book with this kind of violence and subject matter. You know, I was going to write a whole thing about, is there a quota of swearing and extreme violence required to justify the mature readers only label? But it's a silly line of thought, since I know Matt Wagner as a creator has done ample similar stories for Grendel under other publishers. This is simply his wheelhouse. But also, thanks for the heads up on the next storyline so I won't be completely blindsided. Another line of thought, is Wesley or Diane the protagonist of this series? They're both lead characters, so I wonder how you feel about it. Wes assuredly is the hero so far, but there's more narration by Diane, so we readers see more of the story from her perspective. So in spite of the title, is this actually Diane's series?" I mean, we've talked about that a little bit, Tim, right? I mean, I think of them as co-stars, but if you guys feel different, weigh in.
No, I do think they're co-leads, co-protagonists. And from story to story, we kind of see a little bit of a difference. This one didn't have that much first-person narration, really, except for the dreams. I think there were a little bit more of Wes's narration, but it didn't seem like it was nearly that much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The question is Wesley or Diane the protagonist of this series? And my answer is yes. Alexander M. Osias said, "I like the art style in this storyline as it seemed to fit the story. There was an alarming yellow face coloration throughout the first issue that I found in my friend's collection that corrected itself at the end of the first issue and was fine for the rest of the storyline. The story reminded me of the stories of Green Hornet, dealing with Kato's ties to the Chinese community, but obviously so much grittier and reflecting that hard-boiled tone that this crime-fighting series seems to favor instead of the more sanitized stories we normally get in, quote, superhero stories. The tropes of both pulp hero and pulp hard-boiled detectives are very well mixed and very satisfying in this story." Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a pulp story, more than a superhero story.
Ward Hill Terry said, "I only know what I hear on the podcast. The explorations of narrative and motivation and violence are, and I expect, will continue to be major themes of this book. While I can appreciate leaving a reader wondering about the antagonist's origins and history, and leaving us on equal footing with the protagonist, I start to overthink when there are scenes given to the reader that the protagonist can't know. You described some scenes of the face where the Sandman wasn't present, and I understand that this is deliberately an unconventional comic book, but it still feels unsatisfying to know so little about the face. Clearly, the face has been around for some time. He has established a reputation and relationships in the criminal underworld, even including the insular gangs of Chinatown. His fate at the end of the story felt like a cheat. The other aspect that I'm sure will be explored, as you have already been discussing it, is the level and depiction of violence. These kinds of stories, whether in comics or films or prose, almost always make me question the creator's intent. Some seem to want to shock with the gross-out factor. Some seem to want to indulge in their own, possibly perverse, fascinations. I anticipate the discussions you three will have on this title. I don't try to deny that the crimes the Sandman faced in New York in the 1930s, or that any kind of police anywhere at any time, for that matter, are not heinous and disgusting. Even non-crimes like casual racism can be heinous and disgusting. That does not mean I want the storyteller to show graphically and gratuitously those things. There are entire genres of films, books, etc. for that, and I do not care for them. What will your analysis of these stories be like? I am eager to hear.
Well, hopefully we'll see what you say, about this one, Ward Hill Terry. But, you know, again, we had that discussion about, you know, how necessary was some of the things going on in the story. We're just trying to figure out the intent, but good food for thought. Next up, Scott Arthur. Guy Davis was most likely taken on because of his work on Baker Street for Caliber and not for anything he did on Hellboy. I'm not as familiar with Watkiss, but the artist in the next arc, R.G. Taylor, was almost certainly asked because of his work on Wordsmith for Renegade Press. Okay, didn't know that, Scott. Thanks.
On the last episode for our dream sequence, I asked favorite movie related to sleeping or dreaming. Some of the listener responses we got from Ward Hill Terry and Dave Topko both mentioned The Wizard of Oz, which came out in 1939, right around the time these stories are set. Chris Franklin said the original A Nightmare on Elm Street. Noah Tarno said Total Recall and gave a shout out to Rosemary's Baby. Jeff Owens recommended the original Spanish film Abre los Ojos, which is Open Your Eyes. I mentioned Vanilla Sky, and this was what it was partially based on, the Spanish version. Bucky749 mentioned a classic Three Stooges short called Heavenly Days. Brett Miller said Dream a Little Dream. Rob Kelly mentioned Richard Linklater's Waking Life. Scott Arthur said City of Lost Children, which is a great movie, a French movie, if you can find it, with Ron Perlman. Amazing movie, just like visually crazy. Dr. Ange said If Jacob's Ladder counts, that one. If not, Dreamscape. I mentioned Vanilla Sky in my last one. So last time I changed my favorite dream song after some of the feedback, and this time I'm going to also change my favorite dream movie. Jacob's Ladder might be the best dream movie, I think.
Well, thanks, everybody. We love getting the feedback after we talk about it. I really enjoyed reading what everybody had to say. So thanks for doing that. Hopefully we can continue that run here. This time, it's my turn to pick, and my dream sequence question for Max and Ryan is, what's the weirdest dream you ever had? So I'm going to start with you, Max.
Oh, boy. Well, okay, so I have two that I can choose from. One was when I was extremely sick with, like, a stomach bug. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go into that one because it's disgusting. The other dream I had, and it's weird, okay, because look, I'm pulling the curtain back. I'm in my mid-50s. I was 6 years old when I had this dream, and I can still see it in my mind's eye. It was so weird. So in this dream, I am going to a girl's house. I had a crush on a fellow first grader. And in my dream, I'm going to her house, but of course, I'm six, so this house looks like a physical version of the square house you would draw on a piece of paper. I have a bunch of flowers. I go, I knock on the door, I open the door, I go in, and I meet the girl's father, who for some reason is a giant cockroach who starts eating the flowers. That's the whole dream. I don't know what it means. I don't want to know what it means. So any psychologist out there, you can just shut up right now. I don't want to know.
Had you been reading Dostoevsky before that?
Like, 6 years
like
old.
Most five-year-olds do, yes. Yeah. That's why, you know, I read that in kindergarten. Yeah, I don't know.
It qualifies as weird. Qualifies as weird, Max. No question about it. How about you, Ryan?
I was thinking about it today because I was racking my brain what story I was going to tell. And it occurred to me that even though this was my idea to come up with these dream sequence questions at the end of these podcasts, it was really a dumb idea because I do not remember most of my dreams. Like, I'm terrible. I am aware in the moment that I am having very vivid, realistic dreams, almost cinematic at times. And then I wake up and within an hour, I don't remember anything. Most of the time, there are a few dreams that have stuck with me. Two dreams in particular I described on the first episode of Secret Origins Season 2. And then I think a few of the dreams that I kind of remembered, I repurposed as stories for PJ Frightful to read on Midnight Podcasting Hour. There's one other story that does this count as weird? Kind of. When I was a junior in high school, I went on a school trip to Greece. Me and 20-something of my classmates and friends, we were able to go to a lot of the cities around Greece to study ancient Greek architecture and art and history. So that was, I loved it. One of my favorite experiences of my entire life, just being there. And a year or so later, I had a dream where I was back at the Davani Acropolis Hotel in Athens, Greece, where we stayed. And I'm in the lobby, and one of my friends came down there to talk to me. Like, he said that his room was haunted. And I was like, okay, don't go back up there or something like that. And we end up drinking because we drank a lot on that trip. And then walk back up, and we go to his room, and I'm like, it's fine, go in there, it's not haunted. And the hotel actually had balconies by the windows. Like, the windows weren't, like, sealed shut. So I stepped out onto the balcony. All of a sudden, I hear breaking glass at me. And, like, this kind of cascade of glass. Because he, I am imagining, has walked through the glass window. Or been through something like that. And I just see the glass coming down. And I'm looking up, and I don't see him. So I have to rush out of there, run down the hall. Don't wait for me to make the stairs, go up to his room, and I'm running it to his door, and I'm pounding on the door trying to get in because I am sure that he has, like, walked through this window and he's sliced himself to ribbons and he could be bleeding to death and I've got to do something. And I'm pounding on the door and it finally opens and I walk into the kitchen of a girl that I went to high school with.
Wow. Years old,
and everybody's there because it's her graduation party. And I'm like, what is happening? Why am I at this graduation party? And then she comes up and she's with the sister of the friend that I was just having the dream with, who went through this in this hotel room. And they're like, have you been drinking the punch? And I'm like, what? They're like, somebody spiked the punch. But we've got the antidote. I'm like, what antidote? Like, what are they spiking with? Come with us. We're going to get it. And the three of us, me and these two girls, went into her bedroom. And then the dream took a turn. And I'm not going to go into that. but anyway, I was just like, that's one of those dreams that I've always remembered. Like, I was like, I need to write this scene at some point, like up until where the part where it changed. But, like, I have this just visual image of being in this hotel, like on the sort of terrace balcony thing, and just having the glass kind of explode over me and kind of rain down.
Wow.
And
wow,
the sense of dread that my friend was up there and is bleeding out and I've got to get to him. So something was kind of weird, kind of scary, but I don't know. It took a turn. So.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
What about you, Paul?
I'll tell you mine real quick. Like you, Ryan, I remember virtually none of my dreams. But this one I have remembered very vividly since it's either late high school, early college. So it was early 80s. So I'm a little older than you, Max. I just turned 60 this year. And it was early 80s. And at this time, I was a big, and still am, a big Star Trek fan, but there was no Next Generation or anything like that. And I was talking about this in our thread a while ago. I really enjoyed a lot of the novels and all the rest. So I didn't read, like, you know, whatever. So anyway, like, a lot of Star Trek. And my dream was I was going to William Shatner's house, okay, in California. And it was me and my best friend at the time, who was kind of like a cold fish kind of guy. So you can see where this is going. So Shatner says to us, you know, Yeah, I know you're like, Star Trek, that was all real. Come, let me show you something. We go out to his garage, okay, and he opens up this cabinet, and in the cabinet are all these, like, Starfleet uniforms, okay? So we put on his Starfleet uniforms. He opens another door, and we walk out, and where are we? We're on the bridge of the Enterprise, okay? Wow. And then, and my friend, all of a sudden, I've turned into Kirk. My friend has turned into Spock, okay? And we have this mission on the Enterprise, and And then I somehow I get back to, you know, the present day, and he said, "See, I told you." And that was the end of the dream.
Wow.
It's just totally weird. So anyway, I knew that I would have to tell that story at some point, because like you said, Ryan, I don't remember most of my dreams, but that one has stuck with me for, you know, 40 years. So
wow.
Yeah.
Man, I can't wait to hear what the listeners come up with.
I think that about wraps it up, guys.
Yeah, yeah. Folks, obviously leave us feedback, comments about what you thought about this story, but also what are some of your weirdest dreams. This episode, if you're listening to it, should be dropping right before Halloween. So hope you have a happy Halloween. Something spooky, something safe. The next time we reconvene, probably in January, for the fourth story arc, The Vamp, which you can find in issues 13 through 16. But until then, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please support us by subscribing to Justice Society Presents on your preferred podcast app. You can also help us promote the show on social media by liking and reposting.
You can also leave comments on this episode at the Fire and Water website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, under JSA Presents.
Finally, please consider supporting the network on Patreon at patreon.com/FWpodcasts.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next time, pleasant dreams.
Oh, Emmanuel, baby.